From the Sky News Centre at 5, a mother from Staffordshire has been found guilty of murdering her 21-month-old daughter. Victoria Lawrence reports.
23-year-old Catherine Smith dialed 999 as her daughter Aisha collapsed in Burton-upon-Trent in May 2014.
Can you hear any air coming from her mouth?
No, there's nothing. She's gone.
Aisha died from a heart laceration said to have been caused by being stamped on. Smith has also been convicted of cruelty, while the child's stepfather, Matthew Rigby, was found guilty of causing or allowing her death. Police say they told a catalogue of lies.
They were evasive, there was a lot that took place in the hospital, and they were obstructive.
The pair will be sentenced on Monday.
The last remaining suspect on the run after November's Paris terror attacks is thought to be among several people arrested in Belgium. Mohamed Abrini is understood to have been detained earlier over the Brussels bombings. The Prime Minister has been reported to the Parliamentary Standards Watchdog after admitting making money from offshore funds. He insists he hasn't broken any rules and is planning to publish his tax return. The family of a police officer whose remains are thought to have been found in South London have paid tribute to a great character. A man's been arrested on suspicion of PC Gordon Semple's murder. The Pope says the Catholic Church should be more understanding of modern life. He's produced a new document which says couples who live together outside of marriage should be welcomed. Marco Politti is a journalist in Rome and says it provides a fresh description of the family unit.
It's not an idyllic family, but the family with its problems, with poverty, jobless people, homeless people, the violence within the family.
Meanwhile, the pontiffs also strongly reiterated his opposition to gay marriage. And the government advisor on obesity says people shouldn't be blamed for being overweight. Professor Susan Jebb thinks it's mainly down to genetics and unhealthy snacks. That's the latest. I'm Barry Warner.
If you love BCFM, you can now get the brand new BCFM app. It's available on Android, iOS and BlackBerry. Visit your app store for more details. Just search BCFM.
BCFM 93.2.
Getting Bristol home with BCFM.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. Tony Gosling. And on the day Bristol City Council finally published their first list of hopefuls, we have a studio full of mayor candidates. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers has the week off while we spend 2 hours coaxing promises from our current mayor, George Ferguson, all the political party candidates and two independents standing on platforms of poverty relief and education. In the run-up to Thursday, the 5th of May's local elections, I'll be hosting another two-hour-long politics show hustings a bit like this. In a fortnight's time, we'll be doing it all over again with the police and crime commissioner candidates. They'll be sitting here on Friday the 22nd of April. On to the politics show mayor hustings in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 11, sunshine and showers. Windier, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, some sunny spells and fleeting showers. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of April, highs of 14 Celsius, fairly sunny with occasional showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, accountants and auditors can be dangerous people. It was posh-sounding financial services firms like KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers that signed off the bank's accounts in 2007 and 2008 without apparently noticing they had hundreds of billions of pounds, black holes on their balance sheets that were, well, in fact, junk. Anyone who saw the film The Big Short over Christmas will know how risk managers and auditors can get things spectacularly wrong. But it's all okay because Andrew Tyrie MP and his banking commission recommended, didn't they, that our high street and retail banks should be separated forever from the casino banks, so the gamblers of the City of London could never again endanger our hard-earned savings. Only one problem, that never happened. Chancellor George Osborne fudged it by telling us all he might do it sometime in the future. More important than ever, then, that the annual budget of over £1 million here in Bristol, Bristol's mayor should be able to navigate his or her way around the accounts and the city's balance sheet. One thing the mayor really must be able to do for this special occasion. So we'll be looking at that just after 6 o'clock. We have a balance sheet for the last couple of years and also one equivalent from 1947, so we can compare what's being spent today of our money to what was just after the war in another age of austerity. So we have the incumbent mayor plus mayor candidates from Conservative and Labour parties, also Lib Dem, Green and UK Independence parties, and also two independents here. The list of nominees has only just been published today, so not all the 13 candidates are here. Also standing is Tom Baldwin, Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, and four more independents. That's Tony Britt, Stoney Garnett, Mayor Kudihimbu and John Langley. By way of introduction, I'm going to ask all our candidates now to explain why we should vote for them. First of all, from Bristol First, it's the incumbent mayor, George Ferguson. George.
Hello, Tony. As everybody knows, I'm the incumbent mayor, and I stood in 2012 because I felt that Bristol was not getting on with the job it should be getting on with. It was too bogged down in politics, in bickering, instead of taking the tough decisions that needed to be taken. We hadn't invested enough in our infrastructure, our transport infrastructure, our housing infrastructure, and we needed to transform education across the city in an increasingly difficult climate where our education had been split up into a academies, free schools and local authority schools, as well as the private schools. So I felt that I could bring my skills and experience of living and working in Bristol 50 years, being in charge of national and international organisations, to bear on the city. I've not regretted it for a minute. I feel that in 3.5 years we've made some real change in terms of the mood. As anybody knows, that from concept to completion, it probably takes that long to build a housing development, let alone turn a city around. And so we are now on the cusp of making those major changes. We're in a state of relative disruption while we build the new transport system. I accept that, but unless you've got the courage to get on with it, you will never cure the problem. And
okay, George, thank you.
Thank you.
Now over to Conservative candidate Charles Lucas.
Tony, good evening. I'm standing because I want to get Bristol, make a better Bristol for everyone. I want to get Bristol moving by attacking the problems we have with congestion and public transport. I want to give everybody a home. I want to build new homes. We need to build 85,000 new houses in Bristol over the next 20 years, and we are way behind our targets on that. And I just want to make Bristol a better place for everyone that lives here. We're such a fantastic, diverse community, and I just hope we can all take Bristol forward, and I hope that I can lead the city through that.
For Labour, it's Marvin Rees.
Yeah, hi, I'm Marvin. I'm running because I just think this is a fantastic city. But like so many people, I think that while we have a great story to tell to the outside world, and we've certainly done that very effectively over the last few years, there's there are tens of thousands of people in Bristol who are being left behind and who are not included in this wonderful city story that we tell. So it's really important, both for the sake of the integrity of the city and for the sake of any hope of building a prosperous and a strong political and economic future, that we actually prioritise tackling inequalities. We must look forward, we must build a strong economy, continue to support business, make sure that our public sector employers are fantastic. We have a thriving voluntary sector, but we cannot do that while leaving tens of thousands of people behind. Two-gear education process, locked out of skills opportunities and locked out of employment opportunities is totally unacceptable.
For the Liberal Democrats, it's Kay Barnard.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening. I'm standing because, although Bristol is one of the wealthiest cities in the country, I've got really frustrated and angry with the problems that we face when we live here. Transport is a nightmare. Housing is really expensive. The care of the elderly leaves a lot to be improved, and the inequality across the city is quite. Extreme. So the wealth is concentrated in certain areas, skills in certain areas, health. And I want to make Bristol, like everybody else, I want to make Bristol a better place to live. But I think I've got the skills and the experience to do that. And I have a very different perspective, being the only woman candidate from the major parties. I bring a different outlook on the problems that the city faces.
Now, standing for the Green Party is Tony Dyer.
Hello, everybody. The reason why I'm standing is I think this city needs to change, and it needs to change drastically. We are seen as a relatively successful city, but for far too many of us, it feels sometimes as if there's a party going on and we haven't been invited. We have massive divisions and disparities between different parts of the cities in terms of health outcomes, educational attainment, quality of life. We need to invest in the housing that people can actually afford to live in. We need a transport system that works for everybody, it relies on it. We need education systems and skills that are fit for the 21st century. And we need to provide our energy by a means that does not destroy the only planet we have. We need to build a better Bristol. To be able to do that, we need to be able to work together. All of us need to be able to work together to get that better city.
With me from the UK Independence Party is Paul Turner.
Thank you, Tony. Good evening, everybody. As your new mayor, my priorities would be housing, building council housing, making sure that the nearly 200 people we have sleeping on our streets of the city tonight have a roof over their heads. I'd want to review the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit and resident parking zones with full consultation with residents and local businesses. To build and strengthen our economy so that we can actually create jobs for the future, so that our children and our children's children has a job to look forward to. But also accountability and spending prioritisation. I do feel local authority, as it stands now, has been very lax in their prioritisation and their lack of accountability. We need to have transparency. You, as a citizen of Bristol, need to be able to know where every single pound is spent and have the opportunity to question that if you wish to. It seems absolutely ridiculous to me that the top two dozen or so employees at the council can afford to give themselves large pay rises when we have people sleeping on the streets, and we have such good centres across the city like Hawkspring that are having to close down due to lack of funding. Education will be a top priority. We need to make sure that every child in the city has the opportunity of a quality education, but I'll let Christine develop on that a bit later.
Well, funnily enough, I was just coming to Christine Townsend, who is Independence for Bristol. Christine.
Hello, Tony. So I'm standing to raise awareness around the idea that Bristol can only reduce the levels of inequality that we currently have and have had for decades if the structures that separate our children at the age of 11 in their schools and increasingly at the age of 4 are broken down. Our secondary sector has been socially selective for years. Those of us that are Bristolian went to school in Bristol. We know that the posh schools was St. Mary Redcliffe. We know that Bristol Cathedral School has the posh kids, and we know that the City Academy across the road here has concentrations of children that come from disadvantaged backgrounds. There's been a huge piece of massive pieces of research nationally and internationally about the impacts of poor children going to school with large numbers of other poor children, and the impact that has on their ability to achieve their own potential. Bristol, our children they're missing out on achieving their potential, and every day that structure is allowed to be maintained. And it doesn't matter that these schools are academies or they're faith schools, they serve our children, and they need to be serving a cross-section of those young people that are growing up in Bristol right now.
Also an independent standing is Paul Saville.
Good evening, Tony. Hi, I'm Paul. Good afternoon. And when I first started out my campaign, it was mainly around housing and homelessness. I've been homeless twice myself, once when I was 16, once when I was 17. And I've seen what it's like actually on the street. But as I've got more involved in my campaign and speaking to Bristolians and trying actually just to even get access to hustings, what I've realised is that this democratic process is actually a farce, that only certain candidates are being invited to the hustings, selective news reporting in the BBC, etc. And it's just not inclusive. So that's kind of become another point I really want to try and raise as Mayor of Bristol. The truth and transparency thing runs very deep for me. We live in a grotesquely unequal country, but also a grotesquely unequal Bristol, as many people will know. Now, I want to try and do something about that. Now, Paul just mentioned that actually just a minute ago about the service directors at Bristol City Council, Nicola Yates, etc. Now, they've just seen a 20% increase in their pay, whilst our frontline services cut as many people will agree with me, it's just not acceptable. You know, massive pay rises for the top, whilst people sleep in tents on the streets of Bristol in the year 2016.
Okay, Paul, thanks. Now, you mentioned there the hustings. A month ago, three of those people here, George, Marvin and Charles, were invited by Business West, the Institute of Directors and Bristol Junior Chamber of Commerce, to an invite-only hustings at Lee Court near Abbotsleigh. These groups are the local force behind the TTIP trade deal. Yesterday, Lord Owen said the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership would mean the end of the National Health Service. And I'm going to ask particularly you three first, but everybody, what will you do about TTIP? And do you think Bristol should be doing and can do anything about TTIP, which allows big business to sue governments in the future over laws they don't like, and some say means the end of democracy? George, you first.
I think what we've got to do is make quite sure that we use our European representation, that's the Bristol Brussels office and our MEPs, to iron out all those issues that people feel TTIP will damage. And I'm absolutely with them. I think that TTIP is a threat to our local democracy. It's a threat to our environment. It's a threat to many aspects of our lives. But we've got to be practical about it. I don't think it's very useful just to declare a place TTIP free. It's like trying to declare it nuclear free or whatever. Of course, my emotion is on the side of that, but I want to be practical. I want to make change, and that is the way I approach
Charles,
things.
Charles, what do you think of the TTIP? And what can we do, more to the point, and if anything?
Well, I'm not sure what we can do, because obviously this is being dictated to Bristol by central government and other international governments. So the key will be to the devil, I suppose, is in the detail. And until we can see all the detail, we can't possibly comment. Having said that, I am more supportive than many of you of the principle of TTIP. I think there is potential to improve our trading with other countries around the world on the back of it. And I think that there is great potential to be had in it. But as I say, the devil's in the detail.
Marvin, it's a trade deal. Sounds a bit boring, but do you think it's important? Should we be doing something about it?
Well, it's the mayor of Bristol, and to be perfectly frank, it's not something that's necessarily coming up on the Bristol doorstep. What they're talking about is inequalities in the UK, lack of housing. But we do say that as political leaders, we obviously have to take account of the context within which we are hoping to lead Bristol. It makes me feel very uncomfortable, TTIP. I think the burden of responsibility of those advocating for it is to prove that we will be able to protect our vital public services from the encroachment of the power of some of our world's biggest and most dangerous corporations. So absolutely, I mean, like I said, it makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable. But I do think we need to see what details come out of it. And unfortunately, at the moment, a lot of those details are being hidden, which compounds this kind of sense of mystery and discomfort.
Tony Dyer for the Greens.
I think TTIP deal is a very dangerous thing it's going through. I think it has the potential to damage British jobs. It's worth pointing out that the investor dispute system that's going to be part of TTIP will only be available to foreign countries. British companies won't be able to use it within the UK. Only foreign companies would be able to get access to that system. That means that there's a danger it could affect British companies and mean a loss of British jobs. Also, it will allow private companies to sue the government to ensure that public services are made available to private companies when we want to keep so many of them in-house. I'm very, very concerned about TTIP. I think not having enough information is the reason why we should be opposing this on the precautionary principle and saying until we get more information, then we're not prepared to sign up to it.
Okay, Kate Barnard.
Yeah, well, TTIP has been negotiated for at least the past 3 years, I think, and it's probably got at least another year to go, so we don't know the final shape of it yet. As far as healthcare, well, under the previous Labour and now Conservative governments, they can sell off the NHS as much as they like, I think. So I don't think that TTIP will make a lot of difference to that. I mean, a lot of our services have already been privatised. It will have to be ratified by each independent national government. So there is something we can do if we don't like it at the end. We can pressure our own government to reject it, and it will get rejected.
OK, Paul Turner for UKIP.
TTIP is an extremely dangerous trade deal that's going ahead at the moment. There's no doubt that we need a trade deal with the United States of America, but this is not the way to be dealing with it. We need to be acting on our own as an independent nation. It'd be a lot easier, a lot quicker to establish a trade deal. The problem with TTIP is that every single public sector job in this country could be at threat from it. And the only way we can stop it from happening, because it will happen if it's left to the European Union, the only way is to make sure that we leave the European Union.
Paul Saville.
It's hard going at the end, isn't it? Because everyone's already kind of covered stuff. But for me, this is about giving more power to the super rich of the world and taking it away from everyday people like ourselves. So, yeah, I'm absolutely in opposition of this TTIP deal. It sounds very boring as well, doesn't it? TTIP. No one really knows what it's all about. And I think, as Tony said earlier, you know, until we know more about it, then, of course, it shouldn't go through. This is about truth and transparency, essentially. So, we need to kick that into touch, really, innit?
Okay, Christine Townsend.
I've got to say, I'm actually horrified that Charles Lucas describes it as being dictated by central government, because we're actually the people that put central government where they are. I'm no expert about TTIP, I'm no expert with trade, but the idea that massive American corporations can come and sue governments in Europe, and the idea that corporations are going to come in and start kind of supplying our NHS or taking over parts of our NHS fills me with horror. And the idea that central government is going to dictate it for us, I just find that quite insulting, actually.
Okay, let's move on to another tack and start with you this time, Marvin. Do you think spiritual beliefs are important in politics? And if you have any, would you like to share them with us?
Yeah, I think spiritual beliefs are important in politics. I think non-spiritual beliefs are important in politics. Beliefs are important in politics. If you're asking if I'm a Christian, then yes, I'm a Christian.
What about you, Charles Lucas? Are spiritual beliefs important in politics? And would you like to share them with us if you have any?
I think everybody's entitled to their own beliefs, whatever they may be. And I have... I don't care whether people are what religion they are, what their beliefs are, whether they have a belief or not. And I don't believe it's particularly relevant. I think everybody is entitled to their own opinions on that sort of thing.
George Ferguson.
I believe it's ethical beliefs and competence that are important in politics. We want people who understand how to make things happen, and that seems to me much more... You can have all the ideas in the world, but unless you can make them happen. Actually, I find it terribly distasteful the way American politics is dominated by religion, and I certainly don't want to see this country going that way.
Christine Townsend, do you think spiritual beliefs are important in politics?
No, I don't. And the reason for that is that there's some controversy at the moment going on in Northern Ireland around the difference around the Abortion Act and the abortion bills and the legislation that enables women in this country to seek abortion with two doctors, and that doesn't happen to Northern Ireland. And women have been coming over from there to seek abortions, and that's down to spiritual beliefs. And they impact at a gender level in a different way, let's put it that way, because the institutions that have been set up around spiritual beliefs are those of patriarchy.
Paul Saville.
Okay, so there's a big difference between religious beliefs and spiritual beliefs. I would consider myself a spiritual person, but that's my business. It's a personal thing. And, Charles just said it. It's up to the person. I don't mind if you believe what you want to believe, as long as it's not dangerous and... whatever else, and what's the problem? I mean, it's what you're doing in the job for people, representing people, because actually it's when you're the mayor, it's not about you, it's about what people want you to do.
Okay, Paul Turner from UKIP. Do you think spiritual beliefs are important in politics?
I think it's important for politicians to understand spiritual and religious beliefs, but I don't think it's actually important in politics. One of the things I love about this country is that by law, people have the right to practice whatever religion they wish to, as long as it's within the confines of the law. And I think that's something that's fantastic about this country. But no, it's not important that it is part of politics.
How about you, for the Lib Dems, Kay Barnard?
No, I don't think spiritual beliefs are important. What is important in politics is morals and ethics, that you have to act honestly and fairly and treat people with respect. That's the most important thing in politics.
Finally, Tony Dyer.
I think what's very important is what people believe in, and that's informed by many different ways. I'm an atheist. How my values are formed may be different from how other people's values are formed, but there are different ways that can be created, and I think if those values are good values, then wherever they come from, it doesn't matter.
Well, Marvin Rees has just waved his little interrupt card, so go on, Marvin.
Well, it wasn't an interrupt card, it was a I have something to contribute card. I just think we do contend, a number of the contributors have suggested, there is always a danger in the relationship between faith and politics. There's a danger in the relationship between non-faith and politics. There's a fantastic observation, I think it was a great observation anyway, made by Barack Obama before he was well known. And he talked about, who would Martin Luther King be without his faith? Who would Fannie Lou Hamer be without their faith? Who would Malcolm X be without their faith? And the point he was making was, as George referred to the danger in US politics, if you ask people, if people don't have a faith, they shouldn't come pretending to have one. If they do have one, they shouldn't be asked to leave it at the door. The importance is the values you bring to the role and the morals you bring to the role. But whatever the source of that is, as long as you're not imposing it on anyone, you know, as long as we're trying to run to become political leaders, not religious leaders of a city, then that's actually what's important.
Okay,
and I think at the core of that is about the drive towards a more just and caring society.
And now Christine wants to...
I find it interesting that Marvin uses examples from males. Simone de Beauvoir was not in any way spiritual, and neither was Rosa Luxemburg. They came from a completely non-spiritual, non-religious sort of perspective.
Good point. Anyway, thanks. We'll move on now, Tony, to talk about your personal... another one. George, go for it.
I mean, yeah, of course, Marvin took some good examples, but my concern is... the entitlement that it sometimes gives to people like George Bush and Tony Blair and fighting wars for a Christian reason.
Were they Christians?
They used their belief to prop up their reason for fighting a war.
Jeremy Paxman,
and I think that's extremely
dangerous. Jeremy Paxman asked them if they prayed together and they wouldn't answer, would they?
Oh.
Anyway... thanks for that. We're going to go on to talk about the Panama Papers briefly now. I'm going to go around the table and ask you if you can sum up in 30 seconds what you make of these leaks about tax avoidance. And also, if you, maybe starting with you, Christine, what's your personal wealth and how much wealth do you have in tax havens or other tax avoidance schemes?
I couldn't even name where tax havens are other than the ones that are in the papers. What my personal wealth? I don't have a mortgage. That's about it. There you go.
Okay, Paul?
Have I got a tax haven?
Yeah, what's your personal wealth and how much do you have in tax havens?
Okay, so I don't have a tax
haven. Or tax avoidance scheme.
Okay, so I don't have a tax haven. My electric bill's due and it's £170 at the moment, overdue by about 2 months. So that's what I'm trying to chase at the moment, is that £170. It's an everyday struggle, as many people in the city are also facing. So no, I don't have a tax haven.
Okay, thanks very much. And what about you, Paul Turner, for UKIP?
I live in a council flat. I live off £100 a week. I don't have a great deal of money, and I certainly don't have anything stored away in tax havens anywhere.
Okay, what about you, Kay Barnard?
Well, I've got savings that I built up during my working life at over many, many, many years.
Would you like to share with us how much?
No.
Okay.
Why should
enough?
I?
No, it's fine.
Certainly not in tax havens.
Okay, and you, Tony Dyer?
Well, I live with my in-laws. In regards to how much money I have, I'm not absolutely certain. I don't think it's very much, but my wife would be able to tell you better.
Give us a guesstimate, if you're happy to share it.
I have no idea, actually. I think it's probably a couple of £100 in the bank account. That's probably about it at the moment.
Okay, Marvin, what about you? What's
your
personal wealth?
I just want to carve out 10 seconds. What's your personal wealth?
Sorry, mine.
Yeah,
is about £3,000.
Okay,
something
great.
Like that. But anyway,
I like the example that you shared. So actually, my personal wealth has dropped considerably since becoming a candidate, which is one of those things people don't often realise, is that it's a financial blockage to political participation, which frustrates me with the anti-party stuff sometimes. But no, it's okay. I mean, I have a wife and 3 kids, and we get by. But we've taken a big hit from the campaign.
So you don't want to share with us how much?
No, I don't. I don't think my wife would like me to.
Charles
either.
Lucas, what about you? And you know, you do feel free to comment on what you think about this whole Panama Papers business this week, Charles.
Well, to answer the first question about my personal wealth, I have money invested in businesses. I have very little personal money because it's all invested in my businesses. And I have a wife and three children, and life is very expensive. So but I would say that all my money is safely in the United Kingdom. There is no money offshore.
So you don't want to share with us your personal wealth?
No, I don't.
Okay,
thank you.
George, what about you? What do you make of the Panama Papers, and would you like to share with us yours?
I think it's extremely sleazy. I have made and lost money. I've learnt by it over 50 years of working and living in Bristol. I only think money has one single purpose, and that is to do good with it. And so my aim is to make quite sure that I can do the maximum good. And I will share with Marvin, being mayor is not very good for making money either, and it certainly shouldn't be.
I don't know if that's not the public narrative.
George, would you like to share with us what your personal wealth is?
No. I think, it goes up and down so much, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Really? Okay, Tony, you wanted to interrupt there.
Yeah, I just wanted to interrupt very quickly, because the Panama Papers thing is, I think, a very massively important scandal that's happened in our country, and we're in danger of trivialising it a little bit here by talking about individuals' bank accounts. What we have is massive amount of money, which is... Well, taxes have been avoided, and these are the taxes that can pay for the housing all of us want to deliver, for the transport system that all of us want to deliver, the education services that all of us want to deliver. That's much more important than the fact that one of few of us might have a bit more money than one or two of the others of
us. Thanks. And also, Paul Turner from UKIP wants to say something.
Yeah, I very much agree with much of what Tony said there. I do believe that if people are using these tax havens to avoid paying taxes that are due in this country, then they should be prosecuted. There's no two ways about it. Their wealth should be seized, and it should be considered a criminal offence.
Okay, Bristol's mayor has a unique opportunity to publicly challenge Parliament. Sorry, you can only do it once, Marvin. Interrupting. Bristol's mayor has a unique opportunity to publicly challenge Parliament over things like austerity and immigration. Will you speak out for the people that vote for you? And if so, what will you challenge London on? Let's start here with Kay Barnard.
Well, the first thing is to get better investment in our transport services. I use the buses. I use the Severn Beach rail line, and it's shocking the state of public transport in the city. So that's the very first thing I'd want to do, I think, try and sort that out as best I can, get some investment in the city.
Okay, for UKIP, Paul Turner, what would you challenge London on?
Well, firstly, I think any challenges must be for the benefit of all the people of Bristol, not just those that might vote for me or anybody else. Secondly, we have to look at the amount of control that the central government has over funding to the city. One thing I would like to see very much is a lot more of the taxes are actually raised in the city to stay in the city for the benefit of the city and all the people that live here. We can start talking about challenging them on things like transportation, on housing, and many, many other things. But I think the first thing we have to do is turn around to them and say, no, you're not going to take all of this money away from Bristol. We want to keep it here to serve Bristol and the people that live here.
Paul, will you speak out for people that vote for you against London? And what subjects?
Well, the biggest one really is this referendum that I think Bristol deserves over the mayor thing itself. You know, I think people were at the time back in 2012, low turnout of votes. People really didn't know what they were voting for. And now, you know, with the incumbent mayor and stuff, I think people have realised actually he's done quite a lot of damage to Bristol. So I think if Bristol was to be given another referendum, then it might come out different. And I think that's the first thing that I'll be pushing for as the new mayor for Bristol. Get rid of the mayor.
Okay.
Potentially.
What about you, Christine?
I think that the biggest thing actually that's impacting on Bristol and the country is the austerity ideological agenda, and that's hitting all public services. It's also about privatisation, I think, of the NHS, which is what we've seen with the junior doctors, and also the forced academisation. I think that austerity agenda has tentacles that reach all the way down, and that is what I want to see the next mayor going and talking to Westminster about and rallying people in the city behind them?
Well, in a way, this is a special question for you, George, because you've already had the chance to be doing this for the last 3.5 years. What are the main things to challenge London on? And are you proud of your record so far?
I am. It's centralisation. That we have the most centralised government in Europe and one of the most centralised governments in the world. And I think that the devolution deal that we're currently doing is an important start. But we've got to have a financial devolution to come with it. I think we have an appalling tax system. It's unfair. It's virtually a poll tax. And what we need is a local income tax so that we can have a much fairer system in terms of distribution. That would begin to eat into the unfairness that we have in this city. And so to me, it's to add financial devolution to the devolution of powers that we're getting through the current deal.
Now, Paul Saville, you want to interrupt there?
It's more of a contribution. Again, like Marvin said, it's not an interruption. But one of my ideas, one of my policies is actually to bring in a special Bristol tax, which will seek to take money from the corporations which trade in our city. For example, Vodafone, who are notoriously well known for not paying their taxes, generally speaking. But and then reinvest that money into local independent startup businesses in Bristol. For example, like I started off, I really struggled when I started my small business. I sell tea and I really struggled even to buy pots and pans for my business. So the money that we get from the Bristol tax could be put into local independent Bristolian businesses.
Okay, Charles Lucas.
Well, to answer the first question again, Tony, I am would like to make it very clear that I am very free and independent of the Conservative Party in central government. I
what would you take them on over?
I'd take them over on anything that was right for Bristol. I have no qualms about questioning absolutely anything that was dictated by Central London if it was in Bristol's interest.
I mean, is there
anything
you'd like to just share with us now you think is really out of order that you would take them on over?
Well, I mean, there have been numerous recent issues. There are a lot of, high profile in the media activities. The adjustments to personal impact payments and things that were made in the budget were wrong. And I certainly would take them on, you know, challenge them on that.
Marvin.
I think, just as was mentioned earlier, the narrative of scarcity that we are being sold and how that translates into austerity. I think it's an envelope that they're sticking us within that is a false envelope. It's false financial choices. I think that feeds into also a narrative of division. When a prime minister talks about bunches of migrants, while at the same time many of the people in this country feel totally underserved by the country, that sows in divisions that take place on the streets of Bristol and don't help us build a coherent society. Clearly, we need more power. But there's something very important about that I feel very uncomfortable with the idea of central government devolving power to local elites. You know, it's not just about geographical location decision making. We have to take account of the fact that the country, the world, is being dominated by a certain class of people. In the UK, it's the 7% of people who went to independent fee-paying schools. That question of social mobility and inherited privilege and inherited power is something that we have to take on if we want genuine political change, not just taking your political labels off after 30 years.
Tony.
Cuts, cuts, cuts. That's what needs to be challenged. It's the woe myth, the woe Watton story about the idea that the economic crash was caused by the very poor, when instead it was caused by some of the very richest people in this country who are continuing to be rich and whose names are almost certainly going to be cropping up in that Panama Papers. There is money out there. The money is available. There's £90 billion a year avoided in tax avoidance schemes in which people make a lot of money out of. There's billions of pounds that could be raised by a financial transaction tax on the operations of some of the financial services that caused the problems in the first place. That's what needs to be challenged, is that road story. And if we are going to have devolution, and I think we do need devolution, it needs to be real devolution that allows us to collect the wealth that we create in this city and use it and share it with our own citizens.
Well, Tony and a couple of people have mentioned austerity. Let's just have a quick question on austerity with a quick answer from each of you. And actually, let's start with Charles Lucas this time. Charles, austerity is the economic policy which is supposed to deliver success since the 2008 roughly £500 billion bailout of the banks. Is it the right policy and has it worked?
It is working. It is working more slowly than everybody would like. But the scale of the mess
that the coalition government inherited in 2010, and the massive hole in our national budgets was such that it was the method, the policy, if you like, that was chosen to resolve it, and it is working. It's just due to the world economy as a whole, it is working more slowly than we would all like it to.
George.
I think there's a lot of wishful thinking that somehow by taking a completely different tact, all would be wonderful. The fact is that alternative Conservative and Labour governments have both taken roughly the same tack in terms of austerity measures, and while I want more of government, ask for more, we simply have to live within our means, and I think it's about testing what are our means. But I will do everything I can to get the best deal for Bristol within the financial circumstances, but I do deplore some of the financial illiteracy that we hear from certain parties within the Commons currently.
Christine.
Well, for me, it appears that when it was the banks, the money can be found by central government.
Yes, £500 billion.
Yeah, when it's bombing Syria that costs $500,000 each time there's a plane goes out, we can find the money for that. When it's about building nuclear power stations down in Somerset, the money can be found. But when it's actually about ordinary people with the welfare state and cutting disability benefits, then we haven't got the money.
Paul?
Yeah, similar again. I think what we really need to look at is puncturing the myth of austerity. Charles is right to a certain degree. It is working, but it is working for the rich. And many people are waking up to that fact every single day in Bristol. And that's the reality, is that some people have lots in the society. Some people have absolutely nothing. And it's absolutely shocking in 2016.
Well, certainly the current austerity measures, I don't think, are working for anybody apart from, as Paul just said, the wealthy in the country. Certainly myself, and I think many people around this city, would say that they've not seen any benefit whatsoever. But then again, neither is spend, spend, spend the answer. So I think we do have to have a better measured approach. We do need to understand that we can live within our means. However, what I don't think is that we're not really truly seeing what our means are. There are lots of businesses, as we've heard with the Panama Papers, that are sneaking absolutely vast sums of money out of the country without paying tax on it. So I do think the means are there. And I don't think we need to go down the route of the austerity measures that we're currently being applied to us. There is a better way.
Kay Barnard for the Lib Dems.
Well, the recovery seems to have stalled, doesn't it? And further cuts, I think, are being driven by a right-wing ideology that private is somehow good and public services are somehow bad. I think that's something the Conservatives have signed up to, and that's absolutely not something I would agree with. We need good public services, so I don't think the austerity cuts that are proposed now are a good idea at all.
Tony Dyer.
Well, just make it clear, austerity is economically illiterate, and that's why we have had the slowest recovery to a major recession since records began. I'm really getting tired of politicians blaming the previous politician 4 or 5 years ago. If we did that in the private sector, you went in and you were said to your boss, the reason why you haven't hit your target is because of the guy you had the job 4 or 5 years ago. I think you won't last very long in that job, so much for the private sector. Let's be absolutely blunt about this. Christine mentioned it before. We seem to be able to find money to bail out the banks. I think the actual amount that ended up being added onto our debt as a result of that was closer to £2 trillion rather than just the £500 billions. And we can find money for that, but if you're a steelworking organisation, we can't find the money.
I don't want to be too much of a stickler for figures, but I think the national debt is only £1.5 trillion at the moment.
It was £2.2 trillion.
Anyway, Marvin, what's your views on this?
Well, we were, I mean, in terms of advocating for Bristol, we were promised at the beginning of the last campaign that the doors of London were already open to Bristol going and demanding
more resources. But is austerity the right policy?
No, no. I just think it doesn't make financial sense. A number of things. One is, I just want to pick up on that again. It's always referring back to the last government, and actually, and as though it was their policies that caused the financial crisis. I thought that casino banking had something to do with it as well, and we seem to be missing that one off the table altogether.
But it was the last government that bailed out the banks, wasn't it?
Also, I would say that there's something about the cost of the cuts that's never taken into account. And we looked at this in public health. When we begin to cut vital public services that hit the front line, in fact, public health's a classic, we cut spending on mental health, for example. This isn't an abstract. This turns up as a cost elsewhere in the system. So we end up paying somewhere down the line for the interventions that need to kick in when people are hurt, when communities are undermined.
Can I try and pin you down on this, Marvin? Because it was the last Labour government that bailed out the banks and have caused the massive national debt, which is causing, supposedly,
austerity. Bailing out the banks wasn't about causing the financial crisis. That is as a consequence of the financial crisis and a distorted economic order in which some corporations were just too big to fail.
Did we do the right thing by bailing out the banks?
Well, I think we did. I think we had to. Because it was an unavoidable choice.
So we're going to be saddled with this massive debt forever now?
I think so. Well, I'm not saying we're going to be saddled with it forever. That's your choice. But I don't think we should be... I don't think we should be cutting at the rate we're cutting on the backs of the poorest people. But financial institutions were too big to fail. That was the model we had. And I was concerned about the catastrophe we'd fall into if we just let them go to the wall.
Let's move on. The Bristol Society of Merchant Venturers, George's favourite topic, were behind the Cabot reconnaissance and subsequent genocide of 12 million Native Americans, although Cabot obviously wasn't personally responsible for all of that, as well as the transatlantic slave trade, where 1.5 million were killed in the crossing alone. But now they say they give back much more to the city than they take, given that their royal charter means they don't have to submit accounts. Christine Townsend, should we believe them?
We don't know whether to believe them, do we? Because we can't see what they're investing their money in. This organisation are sponsors of our state schools. They've got the Merchants Academy in the south. They've got the Colston Girls Trust, which has got numerous primary schools. But they're also involved, as we know, on an individual basis and, you know, with some kind of other arm's length organisations in numerous other secondary schools and primaries in the city. And I want to know where the Merchant Venture as an organisation do they have shares in if they've got money in insecurities. I've got an issue with them sponsoring our schools.
George Ferguson, you're a former member of the Merchant Venture, so maybe you're best placed to answer this.
My favourite subject, Tony, your favourite subject.
We hear the Merchant Ventures give back to the city more than they take. Can we believe them when they won't have open accounts?
Well, I know that is true. I know from my past involvement with the Merchant Venturers that they give virtually everything to the city in various ways. It's not a take organisation. It is absolutely a giving organisation. It's a charitable organisation. So I understand the history is difficult and challenging, and the slave history is completely is completely unacceptable in every way. But in a way, I think the modern Merchant Venturers are making reparations and invest money into good causes in Bristol.
Okay, Charles Lucas, what do you make of the Merchant Venturers?
They are a tremendous force for good within Bristol. They have turned around, if we're focusing on education, they have turned around one of the most poorly performing schools in Bristol and turned it into a success story.
What was that then?
The Merchants Academy, was Withywood Academy. Sorry, whatever it was called, Withywood School. The merchants also, as part of their good works within Bristol, as you've heard, are charitably focused. They do tremendous work caring for the elderly, and they are involved with giving a great deal of money and time to the city, right across the city, in many diverse ways.
Marvin.
Makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable to have a club It's, to me, it's not about how much. It's not simply about how much money you give away. It's a question of power, and it's a question of inequalities in power. My view is we cannot be true equals until we are talking as equals, and that means equal political power. And no matter what good is done, if you have a group of people who collect together on a class basis, on an education basis, whatever, you know, and they connect and they create opportunity for themselves, and that's a really uncomfortable aspect of Bristol life. I mean, politics, the kind of politics I want, the kind of Bristol I want, is not one where a few people eat the crumbs that fall from the table, even if those crumbs turn into chicken legs. It has to be about we're all sitting at the table shaping the city's future together. And I think it's also a little bit, it makes me feel uncomfortable that while we have electoral politics, there are big decisions being made by people who are unelected in Bristol, huge amounts of influence over the city where people are unelected. We have to look at that. We have to actually address that and take it on and put it in the open.
Tony Dyer, the merchant venturers, should we believe them if when they say they give back more to the city than they take when they don't have open accounts? It's a royal charter.
Yeah, the royal charter, but I think the general problem here is secretive accounting in all its styles. It doesn't matter which organisation it is. If you're secretive about your accounts, then you need the respect to be challenged about that, and you need to respect that people will have concerns and may not believe you. And the only way to get rid of that unbelief is to publish your accounts.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm very suspicious, actually. We don't know, do we, about the money involved. But the wealth of many of the business people in Bristol was built on not just on slave trading, but exploiting former colonies. And it seems to me that from the outside, the Freemasons looks a bit like the Masons. The merchant venture looks like the Freemasons. So, sorry.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I can just contribute quickly here, because they have a junior warden, don't they, George, and a senior warden, who then becomes the master. And that's exactly the same pattern as in the Freemasons,
yeah. Oh, and the other thing is there's almost no women on the trustees or board members or whatever they're called, which again makes me a little bit suspicious.
George, do you want to, as an ex-merchant venturer, answer that about the women point?
Well, I made a very strong point that there should be women, and women were introduced to the merchant ventures, and they made it a damn sight better, as women always do when they come into any organisation. But I think there's too much emphasis placed on power. I don't see the merchant venturers having any power at all. They have no power over me or the city.
Paul?
Well, to actually answer your question, Tony, the answer is no. Without looking at their accounts, you cannot say that they are doing what they're doing financially. And I think it's the same with any organisation like that. Without looking at the accounts, it leaves them open to make whatever statements they wish about how much they're spending here, there and everywhere. But unless you can look at the accounts, you cannot say whether that is truthful or not.
Paul Saville?
Yeah, so I learned a lot of stuff over the last few years about the merchant ventures. The most recent thing is, and actually if the merchant ventures are interested in giving back to Bristol, why don't they give the port back that they've taken off us? George decided to sell it off to two merchant venture friends for £10 million, which was very, very cheap, actually. I think it worked out to be 95 pence per square metre. Don't quote me on that, but it's very low anyway.
It was about £3,000 or £4,000 an acre, wasn't
but,
it?
But just to focus on George, I do believe that Charles is also a merchant venturer, if the internet proves me right. I think Charles is also a merchant venturer. So it's actually... Again, we need
Charles,
to...
Charles, hang on, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a current, current member.
And will you carry on if you're mayor as a merchant venture?
Absolutely.
Okay, not like George then, you won't
nope,
say...
I won't.
You don't think there's a conflict of interest there?
No, I don't.
Can I just finish off, though? But yeah, and the other example, which was, you know, a lot of people really campaigned over it, was the Cathedral School, which was a great, great loss to Bristol. We lost the basement of the Cathedral School, and that was also sold off to a merchant venturer. So it's not even hidden in Bristol anymore. It's very, very open about these sell-offs. It's terrible, and it's a disgrace to Bristol, actually.
George, did you want to say something?
I think I'd better answer the question about the port. I didn't sell the port. The port was sold by the Labour administration in 1996 on a 150-year lease. And all I did was sold the remaining freehold, which had very little value. I was advised that it had a value of hundreds of thousands of pounds. The only buyer that it has value to is the port itself that marries that long lease with this residual freehold. The valuations that were done before I came in were about $3 million to the port as the freeholder. I got a further valuation which doubled that to about $6 million once they knew that we'd done a $10 million deal. Well, because that's what valuers do when they'll so the $10 million was an extraordinarily brilliant price. We did a really good deal. And we still we still retain an investment in the port, 12.5%.
Hang on a second.
And that investment is worth more than the whole port was.
Okay, just a second,
sold it.
George, because the city sold that 2,600-acre port last year to
No, you're wrong. The city
the actual
sold
freehold
the long
of it.
Lease
the
on
freehold
that.
Was sold
yeah,
last year,
yeah,
wasn't it?
The freehold is the residual freehold, which has, on a peppercorn rent, has virtually no value.
Can you just finish, and then you can reply once I've just said this. So it was sold to David Ord and Terence Morden for £10 million.
It was sold to the company.
Now, that's about £4,000 an acre. The 12-acre Wallon site was sold for £6 million. That works out about £500,000 an acre.
That wasn't on a land leasehold.
Just let me finish. The land value, the 2,600-acre port, was worth $1.3 billion if you were to use
that as an equivalent, which is a lot more than the
£10 million that we got for it.
Tony, excuse me, that is a wonderful example of financial illiteracy, and if you were running the city, I'd be terrified.
So would you just like to explain why it's...
Because I've explained it. If you sell land on a long lease or freehold...
Okay, how long was the long lease?
Till 21,
how much was the long lease
It went
for
from
well?
1996 to 2141, by which time the port would probably be underwater.
How
because
much
of
was
raising
the long
sea
lease
levels.
Sold for as well then? Because then if you add that to the freehold, that's the total cost of the land to the port, isn't it?
No, not at all. It was sold with the port company coming in, and in 1996. It's absolutely not true. What matters is the fact that we don't own the land. We didn't own the land apart from the residual freehold. We were getting a peppercorn, nothing, no rent. We had no value out of it until 2141. It would probably be underwater by 2141 and therefore probably have a pretty small value. Extracting 10 million and then being able to invest that in regeneration and housing, as will be done, makes absolute financial sense. I'd be terrified if you lot were running the city if you think that was a bad deal.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that, but there's a lot of criticism of it because looking at the value which the land has subsequently been sold for being so much more than we got for the whole estate. That, I think, is where people would question
this. That is selling the whole freehold. It's very different. And I know it's difficult. You know, sound bites are easy. Selling the port, flogging the port. It wasn't flogging the port. It was just that small value of the residual freehold, which we probably got 10 or 20 times the third-party value of it.
Does anyone want to have a final say on the port? Paul?
Just a quick thing, just to finish off. I mean, some of my friends down in Avonmouth, it's to do with the port as well, but they are really affected by the poor air quality down there. They're going to be building a tar factory down there and an incinerator to burn London waste.
Okay.
I find it absolutely abhorrent what's going on in Avonmouth, actually, port aside.
You're listening to the BCFM Politics Show, Bristol Mayor Hustings. Another hour to go after the news, where I'll be asking our mayor for the last 4 years, George Ferguson, some specific questions about the £1 billion or so of our money he's been responsible for spending every year. And also get the other candidates to comment on what how they would like to spend the same
this
chunk.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio.